Radhika Jones, editor-in-chief of Vanity Fair. If you enjoy binge-watching the best TV shows and love hearing from the actors and showrunners who make them happen, then subscribe to Vanity Fair. Our Hollywood reporters take you behind the scenes of the year's most anticipated projects, the industry's biggest moves, and the hardest-fought awards races. From The Crown to The Real Housewives, we've got the inside scoop. As a special thank you to our still-watching audience, we're offering 15% off a yearly digital subscription to Vanity Fair. Visit vanityfair.com today and use promo code POD15. That's vanityfair.com, promo code POD15 for 15% off a yearly digital subscription to everything you want.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Are you driving your car or doing laundry right now? Podcasts go best when they're bundled with another activity. Like Progressive home and auto policies, they're best when they're bundled too. Having these two policies together makes insurance easier and could help you save. Customers who save by switching their home and car insurance to Progressive save nearly $800 on average. Quote a home and car bundle today at progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $793 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2021 and May 2022. Potential savings will vary.
Why are you following me?
The stuff you wear isn't appropriate for what you're planning on doing.
You don't know anything about me. I'm ready.
You're not. And none of the stuff that you're thinking means anything anyway.
Never kissed anyone before.
Hello and welcome to Still Watching. I'm Vanity Fair senior writer Joanna Robinson.
And I'm Vanity Fair chief critic Richard Lawson.
If you're just joining us for the first time, what we do on this podcast is Richard and I pick usually one TV show at a time that we are watching kind of obsessively, and we break it down week by week, talking about each new episode. But right now we are in the midst of an overlap. We're in the thick of an overlap. So you may have seen our first episode covering the new HBO miniseries, The Undoing, that dropped on Sunday night. This is Monday night, and we are finishing up. We Are Who We Are. We've got two more episodes. This is the penultimate episode of We Are Who We Are. So you'll have 2 weeks of overlap of double HBO from Richard Lawson.
We Are
Jordan
the
Robinson.
Undoing.
Who are we the doing? Are we here for you?
What are we doing?
What are we doing? And then also in the midst of all of that, there will be a special one-off episode covering The Mandalorian from Anthony Breznican and myself. So an embarrassment of riches. What else do you have to think about right now in end of October, early November? Nothing else could possibly be on your mind. And that brings me to my central question of this episode of We Are Who We Are, episode 7. Is that what we're on? The penultimate episode?
Yeah.
I want to get to some emails, but I just want to like drop my main thesis before we get there. Richard, was this show about actually about the Trump election all along?
Kind of feels like it, doesn't it? Like,
yeah.
Secretly, like, I feel like there were a couple things in this episode that kind of walked up and slapped us in the face and was like, why weren't you paying attention?
Yeah.
You know? And I think that feeling is maybe one that a lot of us felt a couple days or in that night, you know, of the election, a couple days after or that night or months after or whatever, was just like, man, we didn't see a bad thing coming until it was there.
So the as we mentioned last week's episode ended with Sarah getting the news about this convoy while she's watching, you know, the results of the election night. So everything, you know, if we were to divide this show into two parts, pre-election, post-election, like everything we're watching now is post-election. And so, we're going to break it down, but I watched this episode twice. And the second time through, I was really thinking about it as like a dark mirror of what we've seen before on the show. So, And I would be more resentful of that potential premise were it not for the fact that I think the show has just done really excellent character work all along. And so I am emotionally invested in these characters. So I don't mind if their emotional journey is also a larger metaphor for this dramatic event we went through together. Mm-hmm. So, yeah. All right. So before we get into like the specifics of the episode, we are going to hit some listener emails. You can always email us stillwatchingpod@gmail.com. We've been getting some incredible emails all season long from you guys. Thank you all so much. So let us start. So Giovanni, who emailed us, I don't know, last week or the week before, emailed in response to my question about the shot of, Sarah and Maggie sort of staring down the camera at each other and whether or not we felt like this is something Luca Guadagnino had done before. And, Giovanni linked me to this iconic scene from Bigger Splash that I'd forgotten where it's like Tilda Swinton up against a wall, sort of looking back at Ralph Fiennes. It's a very similar shot. And mm-hmm. like that image of her up against like I think it's like a blue, pale blue stucco wall with like beautiful winged eyeliner sort of like looking at him. I was like, oh, of course. Yes. The answer is yes. Luca has done this before. And, Giovanni points out that he did it earlier, in the series with a shot between Danny and Craig, which sort of comes to bear in this episode because Danny is one of the people hit hardest, by the loss of Craig in this episode. So, there we go. And then Owen wrote in to talk to us about further about Blood Orange, which we talked about as the overarching musical influence of this series last week. Owen writes, in episode 6, the dance number is a recreation of the actual music video for Blood Orange's song Time Will Tell. That song itself is a mashup of two of his songs, Champagne Coast and It Is What It Is. Time Will Tell has obviously been a prominent song throughout the series so far, and I find that really interesting considering it isn't one of Dev Hynes' most popular songs. The lyrics of the two songs, which he included in Time Will Tell, present an interesting combination of ideas, and I think the fantasy dance sequence brings those ideas to a peak. It's like a physical manifestation of those lyrics shown through the dance they do. I don't quite understand it fully, but I thought it was a great sequence to include. I do find it a little bit odd and self-indulgent to see Dev's music being featured so heavily in the show, mostly because of the scene where Fraser says Dev Hynes is a musical genius. That recreation of his own music video adds to that layer of self-indulgence, but I can appreciate that to an extent. His music is so atmospheric and fits the energy of the show perfectly. Do you have any thoughts as to what the significance of that scene was, if you care to explore it further? Of course, I'm a first-time listener of this podcast because I wanted to hear someone talk about the show, but I will definitely be listening to future shows you discuss. Y'all are amazing. So thank you, Owen. Glad to have hooked you with this weird show. I think we discussed this last week that we felt like that sequence, that fantasy sequence, was something of like a this is our bubble, this is our shared bubble sort of moment. Richard, did you have a further interpretation of it?
No, I mean, just to kind of restate it, it's like it's an illustration of that intense friendship that people that age can have, especially when they're a little, they feel they're a little outside, on the outside of their immediate community. It's just, you know, us two weirdos against the world kind of thing. That's a really powerful bond, and one that does create its own sense of escape, you know? And I think that's kind of what this was illustrating. And it's a bit sad in a way to think of it just, you know, happening so recently in this show's timeline, because it feels like after this episode, everything is kind of torn to bits.
Right. In this episode, a couple things happen. One, like, I think we see Fraser kind of at his most possessive. He says twice, what does it have to do with us? Like, what does Sarah have to do with us? Or what do they, her sort of her old friends, have to do with us? You know, the way he's just sort of like physically holding on to Caitlin Hunter. So that is interesting. And then also, yeah, just this sort of like before and after things, this, you know, we'll talk about this a little bit more, but like one of the like Trump election themes that I felt like really shone through in this episode is this idea of like tribalism and circling the wagons around your unit. And like, how does their unit survive that when they're trying to be, when other people are trying to pull them into these other pre-existing units? Does that make sense?
Yeah, definitely.
All right. So Brayden wrote in a couple questions for us, a couple prompts. Number one, if frequent Guadagnino collaborator Tilda Swinton were to have a cameo on the show, what sort of character would she play, Richard? Any thoughts? Dream casting Tilda on the show.
Well, some sort of Italian magistrate who like visits the base or something.
I like that.
You know, right? That would sort of work. Or, oh, I know what. The owner of the Russian villa that they destroyed.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
My piano.
What have you done?
What have you done with my piano? I would love to see that. Okay. And then we've got prompt number two. HBO is known for shows with nudity. Any thoughts on the very different semi nudity represented here? Obviously, there's like a couple. You know, notable instances, but in this episode we get a newish scenario, which is Sarah sort of changing in the middle of a situation room setting. So this might be a good opportunity to talk about that scene and specifically, what's your read on that, Richard?
Well, I think with a lot of Sarah, her characterization, there's an admirable boldness to that moment, and also a really strange self-involved kind of exhibitionism to it as well. You know, I think that especially given that there's this gory, these images playing on the big monitors in this kind of command center of these three young people who were just killed. And I understand that what she is communicating is that like, it doesn't matter. Like we're all soldiers here. That's what she says. Who you know, we can't care about such petty things as, you know, body shame or politeness or whatever in these moments. And I totally get that.
However.
But.
Yes.
Knowing what we do of her up to this point.
Yeah.
I can't help but feel there's an aspect of it, which doesn't negate the other aspect of it, but it's there too of like, yeah, look at me, you know, like,
yeah.
And that just seems true of who she is. She's a complicated leader.
Yeah, that other people's discomfort, it feels transgressive to me, especially given the like moment that they're going through, and that it just like it would have taken, you know, half a minute for her to duck out the room and change elsewhere.
And I think crucially, yeah, her eyes are not still on the monitors. It's not like I literally can't move from this spot,
right,
because I can't. I have to.
Because I'm shouting orders or like, yeah, whatever. Yeah,
no,
exactly.
It's not that. Yeah. It's more a show of something than it is a practicality, I guess.
Right. And Jonathan's involvement in it as like, you know, in dressing her is, you know, I'm sure part of his job description, but also just feels like just yet another power play kind of thing. So, all right. And then the last, and I think especially for a show that is, that has a character like Harper at the center of it, who is trying to figure out their body, their identity, how they feel about it. Like that changes the times we see both male and female bodies on display. You know what I mean? When you have a character at the center of it who is feeling at times or maybe at all times like they're in the wrong body sort of thing. So, yep. All right. The last prompt from Brayden is, I'm really impressed by Jack Dylan Grazer's very physical performance, the way he maneuvers doorways and hallways and spaces with his very clumsy adolescent body, the way he flicks the book he's giving Jonathan when he pulls it out of the packaging, the way he seems to embody frenzy. Any thoughts? Is that working for you as well? Yeah, I mean, like there are times when it, you know, we talked about this a lot in the first episode. There's times when it's tough to watch Frasier because of that chaotic energy, but I've grown to have a lot of warm, soft feelings for this kid, and so then his frenzy often reads less as annoyance to me and more just like seeking, like he's seeking calm, he's seeking peace somewhere and not finding it, and that's, I don't know, that's where I am with his character right now. And I do agree, I think Jack Dylan Grazer is doing a great job with that performance.
Yeah, I mean, I think because it, you know, this Frasier is at a strange age, at a strange time, and in a strange place, and reacting strangely to that. Almost his reaction sometimes to things don't feel at all even related to the whatever stimuli are surrounding him. They kind of seem sourced from some other kind of unknown place. But that's kind of weirdly a familiar feeling, you know. It's like, and I think that the way that that stuff kind of the surreality of being on this base at in 2016, right after the election, like then runs headlong into the surreality of death. And especially when you're a young person, and maybe this is the most significant death you've experienced in your life, let alone a peer, not like right. your grandma. And how fucking strange that is, and how there is no right reaction. There's no really wrong reaction. I mean, within limits.
Right.
And really, I think that you know, I think when people say, oh, I felt numb, I think, at least in my personal case, like I assumed that to mean some sort of actual physical coldness or a kind of a sense of muffled stasis, you know, like I'm numb, I'm frozen. It's not that. It's just there's almost this kind of bizarre blankness that sets in. And watching Frasier both have that in himself, but also awkwardly bounce off of other people's shock in this episode, I think, again, is a really strong example of this young actor's like, and Guadagnino's as a director, like their keen awareness of like how one's body might function in all of this strangeness.
Yeah. I really, really like that. This next email comes from Eliza, who identifies as they, them, in their signature. And Eliza wrote us a lovely, really long email. I'm going to take one section. It was really interesting in this episode to hear in context a line that's in the podcast's opening sound cue. Frasier says, "None of the stuff that you're thinking means anything anyway." I wasn't sure what that would refer to, but it makes so much sense that he is saying it to Harper in reference to all of the efforts they are putting into their gender performance. As a non-binary person myself, that really hit home. Sometimes, especially early on in understanding your gender identity, when it is not aligned with your gender assigned at birth, you get really caught up in the performance of things. Do I look androgynous? Femme? Mask? Do I look like I fit into static binary ideas of gender enough? Or do I rebel against them enough? Especially as Harper is trying to pass, that's in quotations, that is something that they seem to be very focused on. And that is, of course, awesome if that's where they feel most at home and comfortable with themselves. But I think what Frasier is saying with that line is that identity is about so much more than just the presentation and performance. Of course, that's a huge part of it for many folks in terms of comfort and even safety. It's also about how you feel, what's happening inside. Harper is at the stage where exploring involves a lot of the externals. And it seems to me that Frasier here is suggesting that Harper's validity doesn't come from how they look, but how they feel. It's possible I'm wrong, because even in 2016, the dominant narrative was still very much centered on trans identity within the binary. But if anyone might have been clued into it, it seems like it would be Frasier. And then Eliza goes on to say, on another note, it's just really nice to hear folks like you talking in a sensitive and serious way about characters slash a show that deals with the complicated gender and sexual identity. Just want to say thank you for having navigational conversations between yourselves publicly. Hopefully that makes other folks also consider their own language and perception. Well-intentioned people so often shy away from complex discussion of gender for fear of being wrong and ending up not trying at all, which is way more harmful than continuing to try. Like with pronouns, for example, I wish more people knew that I and other trans non-binary folks would rather you try, get it wrong, and say sorry than try again, as opposed to just disregarding it altogether. So thank you for that. So thank you for that email, Eliza. Like, I definitely have had my own anxieties, as we've talked about on the show, of like getting it wrong. And thank you to everyone who's written in and sort of given their opinion or guidance on how we might be even better talking about something like this. Richard, I was wondering if you had any response to what Eliza wrote.
Well, yeah, I mean, I appreciate Eliza writing in and listening, and you know, I wouldn't ask anyone to like, be sensitive to me. I'm just figuring this stuff out. You know, I'm not saying that, but I think that like, yeah, the point is to have conversations that might feel uncomfortable, but like get us to hopefully a common understanding. And I think that, you know, as it pertains to the show itself, like that sort of that back and forth, that push and pull, and many in kind of omnidirectional, you know, unsureness. Like I think in this episode, you see, you know, this conversation about hormone therapy, and Fraser, who's so supportive, then saying, "Oh, it's all, you know." I think there are limits to Fraser's compassion and understanding, and progressiveness about this. But I think Fraser is putting sort of these limits on it for whatever reason that doesn't mean that he's a bad friend to Harper. It just means that, like, especially for people that age, like there's not necessarily a right sort of supportive path through.
Right.
And I think that, like, but I do think at the same time that conversation is set in the episode when it is to juxtapose, like, you know, Fraser's kind of youth and sort of like hypothetical thinking to, like, well, it's very real in Harper's case. And then another very real thing comes crashing in the form of these deaths.
My partial read on Fraser's insensitivity around that subject, when he says something like, you know, hormones will give you cancer, whatever it is he's saying, it's partially part of that, like, frustration that his mom is involved in this. You know what I mean? That, like, I think, you know, it might have equally as much to do with other limits in his understanding of things. But I think this idea that Sarah is somehow integral to this decision for Harper makes Fraser immediately resistant to it. So that's my read on that.
We've all been there before. You're planning a dinner party or having family over or even just cooking for yourself when all of a sudden it starts to feel overwhelming.
I live in a very small one-bedroom apartment with a very small kitchen.
I can't figure out what to serve besides water soup at this point.
I'm Chris Morocco, food director of Bon Appetit and Epicurious, and this is Dinner SOS, a new podcast from Bon Appetit. Maybe it's a last-minute party with no menu inspiration. A kitchen with no space. A toddler who will only eat buttered pasta. Name your dinner emergency. We're here to help. Here's how the show works. On each episode, we'll take a call from a home cook facing a real dinner emergency. Then I'll work with one of our editors or someone from our amazing test kitchen to try and solve it. Because cooking for the people you love should inspire joy without a side of stress. Make sure you're following Dinner SOS wherever you're listening now.
All right, let's talk about a couple before and afters. let's start with the party at the Russian house. I think this is one of the clearest before and afters. I mean, we talked about this in the first party episode, in the wedding episode, how it felt like a you know, Craig saying goodbye to something. And that I don't think we were surprised that Craig, it's sad, obviously, but I don't think we were surprised to find Craig on the casualty list here. It seems to be what the show was telegraphing this. But that doesn't make it any less sort of impactful, especially for these kids who, as you say, this might be their first time dealing with death, certainly with death of someone who is so close to them in age. And so this idea of, like, putting the youthful exuberance of the first party at the Russian house through a dark mirror with a stormy night outside, and then just giving us this nightmare. I mean, I was anxious through that party episode, but now that party episode just feels like a beautiful summertime, youthful romp, celebration of love and life and carnal appetites. And this just feels like, you know, it's a bad trip for Danny specifically, but for all of them, really. The constant clanging of metal and the awful lighting and everything that's just happening in that sequence. Richard, how did it sit with you?
Yeah, I mean, I think that we knew that earlier episode with the house party was sort of meant to be kind of prelapsarian. You know, it was about a lost Eden that an innocence, maybe, let's say, even though nothing they were doing was all that quote-unquote innocent, but
sure,
by certain standards. I didn't know necessarily that the show was going to kind of pendulum so hard in the other direction. I mean, I felt some sort of some disaster cataclysm felt looming. And I don't think that that, by the way, I don't think that wave has crashed yet. Not fully. But yeah, I mean, I think that there is a poignant, there's still a poignancy to the older episode in that, like, this was the last time that these kids would all be together. It was the last time that maybe they all could have felt young, truly, you know,
and safe.
I think, like, you know,
and immortal.
Yeah. You know, I mean, like, I was much older, but I was like 28 when one of my best friends died very suddenly. And I haven't really thought about it in these terms that often, but I think in some ways, like, and granted, 28 is kind of old to have this realization, but I think a lot of me and my, a lot of her other close friends were like, oh, we're adults now, you know, like all of the, because what it does in a weird way is color youthful memory as over, because it, you know, if one person's gone, then that era has officially ended, you know? So I think that's, that poignancy is still there. But if you want to zoom out a little further and look at what I think you and I both, Joanna, suspect has become a sort of allegorical show, then I don't know how I feel about the possibility that this whole arc, this friendship, was meant to be almost like Obama era times before the fall. You know, I don't know if Guadagnino and the two other writers are being that literal about it. But I don't know. It makes the show something a bit pricklier and certainly colder and more shrewd. Whereas I think in the early episodes, I thought this was this kind of like rambling gush of teenage emotion and exploration.
Yeah.
And now I think it's something a bit more fixed and more downbeat. Yeah.
I think, yeah, it's... You know, I hopefully someone will ask them, and maybe I should do my journalistic duty and ask them. But like, I am curious how concrete that metaphor feels for them as creatives. For me, you know, I don't want to be too like precious and cute with a parallel or anything like that. But I think the episode itself is making that really clear in the moment where when Sarah is called out for sending these troops out too early, ill prepared. She says the thing where she's like, haven't you been watching the news? People want a leader who can make tough decisions.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Right. She is calling herself the Trump of this scenario, which is wild. but it, you know, if you put Sarah in the Trump role, which is where she puts herself, then, you know, you were talking, I think it was last week, just sort of about this idea of like this family of Sarah and Maggie and Frasier coming in and sort of like feeding off this other family next door. And like, I don't want to call, you know, Richard's a Trump supporter. I don't want to call like Richard's family like an idyllic, like, you know, they have their massive problems over there next door. But this idea of like Sarah as a Trump-like figure coming in and causing this huge tragedy and refusing to take any responsibility for it, I don't know. I can't help but think that that's what we're watching here. So
yeah, I mean, and I think it's also like to the helplessness of suddenly being under new authority. You know,
yeah.
It's such a weird feeling where and a scary feeling, and depending on the circumstance, where it's just like, wait, all of a sudden, like the material world looks in the same, and yet like the rules are somehow different now, and value system seems to have shifted either big ways or little ways. And you know, it's interesting that the Trumpy guy in the show is the one lashing out against the in ideology, maybe anyway, in this like instance, Trumpier figure, you know, like, and I think that what it's kind of showing is it's like a little American microcosm in a foreign country where there's this ever undulating shifts in power and resentments, and what gets lost in those shifts is in this case the lives of three people, you know,
right,
that they just kind of fall through the fault line, and not that they get forgotten, but they get remembered in the wrong way, or they get pinned, their lives get pinned to the wrong cause, you know, and justice is never done. And I think that frustration, that anger, is so palpably at the center of this episode.
It is interesting to me that, like, I don't mean to sound, I really don't want to sound callous about this, because obviously it's like a tragedy when anyone dies, but this seems like, I have to imagine that they experience casualties among their troops, you know, occasionally, sometimes, right? Doesn't this feel like this was like the first time anyone had ever died on the base or from the base? You know what I mean?
Yeah, I do. I know what you mean. I don't know enough about the statistics in terms of, like, you know, deaths have slowed to, I mean, I wouldn't want to reduce any death to a trickle, but like, right, it's not what it was at its peak. Yeah. And maybe it was something about this particular unit that went out. Maybe they were particularly young. Maybe the real anger is that because they weren't trained, and like, there's a feeling of like, it was avoidable, more avoidable than past deaths. I don't know.
Yeah. I mean, the way that Craig hits like our teens personally, is completely understandable. And the way it hits like Jenny, who thinks of Craig as like almost another son and stuff like that, like a lot of that makes sense to me. Or like Richard, who personally trained them. But the way we see it sort of hit base wide, you know, and I was also confused. I don't mean to like, you know, overly nitpick an episode, but the reveal in the school was also a little confusing to me, because like, how many of those kids have a brother? I'm still confused about like Sam and Craig and their existence on the base. Like, how many kids in that school have a brother that's also on the base? Because I would assume that most of those kids were the children of people on that base, you know?
Couldn't it be multi-generational? Like a parent serving and a kid serving?
I don't know how often that happens, but like, so anyway, it was just an interesting, like, slow reveal to Harper, to Danny, to, via Brittany crying, via the missed calls from Sam, all that sort of like that felt like a slower reveal. But maybe that's very insensitive, and maybe the truth is like, you would deny the likely reality of a friend death for as long as you possibly could in that scenario. So, all right, let's talk about another Through the Looking Glass sort of moment. And that, I would say, would be what Frasier does when Harper goes off with her old friends and he's left to his own devices. First things first, he tries to go to the movies. Very relatable frustration of not being able to go to the movies. We're all feeling that right now. And then he goes to Jonathan's, and there's this like seemingly attempted seduction by Jonathan and his lady friend of Frasier, and Frasier's rejection of that. And this like, sort of hellish vibe of something that had landed to us, at least, as like, maybe there's a frisson of danger there, but there was also just like something really sweet feeling about the Jonathan and Frasier interaction before. Did you have the same interpretation I did? Like, how did you feel about it?
Yeah, this was the moment where I was like, oh, this show has been fucking with us the whole time.
Yeah.
Should we have been seeing that Jonathan was grooming this kid this whole time? You know, should we view it as grooming? Was that trip with the girlfriend just kind of showing up unannounced? I mean, you know, Jonathan knew she was coming, but like Frasier didn't.
Right.
You know, is this their pattern? Is this their routine? You know, we don't know those things necessarily, but like, it was immediately clear when he answered the door in his underwear. I was like, something's not right.
Yeah.
You know?
Yep.
And then it proceeded to get more and more not right.
Yeah.
And I think that you know, from a filmmaking standpoint, like that scene is so well choreographed to kind of just be that little tumble into something completely that forever changes a dynamic, forever changes a reality, but happens in a kind of fluid moment, you know?
Yeah.
And I think that, like, you know, many young people, older people too, have that moment where it's like, oh, I guess this is like happening and now things are different, you know? And I think that was articulated well. The problem is that there's a massive power dynamic, a massive age difference happening here, in a way that I think what was so brilliantly done about the scene was that, like, it's not quite what Frasier wanted in his fantasy, maybe, but it's close enough. And then it's really, he's not, it's not what he wanted at all. And I think that you know, a lot of kids who get involved with older people in some way, a crush or something more, have that moment of like, it's not that they kind of realize their age and limits in a way. Not everyone does, obviously, but yeah. So I don't know. I mean, I really empathized with him in that scene, and I really thought the scene was well staged, but in a bigger thematic way, I don't know. It feels like the show kind of, and maybe appropriately, scolding our investment in that relationship. Mm. Or maybe we're being, you know, Puritan Americans about it. I don't really know. Where do you fall on it?
Well, I just think it's just another example in this episode of like the things that you thought might be charming or full of joy in this new reality are not. You know what I mean? I think that goes for Jenny and Maggie as well, and we'll talk about that in a second. But like, you know what I mean? Like the moments of like beauty and joy with an exception, I would say, in the closing couple shots of the episode, actually. But I just think that that's, I don't know that it's scolding us. I think it's more like, you know, it did want us to feel like glowing and happy and charmed by these various things. So that when it pulled the rug out, we felt the loss of them. You know what I mean? And, you know, on a more superficial level, I do always love those moments in film and television. I was just watching screeners for the Netflix series The Queen's Gambit, where like an exact same thing happens, where a character goes to, you know, someone that they've been attracted to goes and sees where they live for the first time. And they're like, and the glamour falls away a bit.
Yeah.
And you're like, oh, you have like a sit-up machine in your apartment and half-eaten pizza, and this is your decor, and this is, oh, you have a snake. Like, I don't know. Like, this is how you live. And like, I'm not judging Jonathan's apartment necessarily, but Fraser certainly is. And he's like, this isn't the like beautiful figure, intellectual figure up on a pedestal that I had, you know, where I had placed him, sort of thing.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does make sense. I mean, well, first of all, I just reviewed Queen's Gambit. Everyone should watch it. It's really good.
It is.
But I think, yes, I think absolutely there is judgment there. But I think also it changes the terms of how he knows Jonathan slightly, also in a, for a brief second, alluring way, because it brings him to earth. I think that, you know, he looks at the bed where the sheets are unmade, and he realizes like, oh, he like fucks in that bed, you know,
right.
like he's a person who like, and so is she. And there's like a real, there's like a kind of, I mean, whatever, a carnal reality to him all of a sudden that is not just this kind of crushy fantasy, you know? And that's appealing for a second. But then I think because Fraser's young and maybe inexperienced, like, that gets very overwhelming very quickly, which is a totally normal reaction to that kind of thing.
Right.
And I think that that's so well calibrated because, you know, like Jonathan looks cute in his little tighty whities and whatever. And like the moment seems dangerously teeming with possibility and like it could actually happen. But then when he realizes like what that happening might actually, and I don't think it's just because the girlfriend's there. I think if the girlfriend hadn't been there, it probably would have still felt to some extent not right.
Yeah. You know? Yeah, I do. I agree. And watching that scene, I was like, I don't know which way this is going to go. And also what I should be rooting for. Like, will there be some sort of like merciful escape in Fraser experiencing this in this moment? Will that be actually kind of a healing distraction for him in this moment? And him choosing to leave, you know, helps me understand his discomfort and how that wasn't right for him in that moment. You know what I mean? But like it really could have gone a number of ways. And I was sort of like ready to try to understand why it would go any of those ways, you know?
Yeah. And then the unfortunate but also again somewhat realistic thing is that after he leaves, which was the right thing to do, he's chastising himself while also mourning the sudden thing that's now changed. I mean, it's like the friend dying. It's like, well, now the past is irretrievable. You know, like Jonathan, like he knows he and Jonathan will probably not go back to the old way. But he also, so that there's a kind of sudden mourning of that, but there's also just like, he clearly is like, oh, I fucked it up. I should, you know, and it's like, no, you should have left. Like, it was good that you left. But he doesn't quite maybe know that, you know, in some ways.
Yeah. And the, I might mispronounce this word slightly, but I am fond of typing it, so I'm going to try to say it. It's anhedonia, right? That's how you would pronounce it. Just this like inability to access pleasure. And I feel like that's a theme of the whole episode for everyone. You know what I mean? Because like he then goes and drinks alcohol in a way that is not, that is just like trying to create a numbing agent, right? Just like
to feel that actual numbness that
people
think they're gonna feel.
All right, so let's talk about Maggie and Jenny in this episode, because we get a scene of them undecorating the hall of its Thanksgiving decorations to set up for this memorial service, and we get the complete sort of dissolution of their affair, which again was like, I thought, a joyful thing in its own way, and then just completely falls apart. Part of this is like, this is partially instigated by Jenny in terms of like being very much like a, you don't understand like what we as a community have lost here. You're new. You didn't know Craig well enough. You didn't think of him as a son the way that I do. And then also like you just mentioned with Frasier, Jenny is kind of irrationally, but what's rational in grief, blaming herself and their affair for, you know, Craig's death, which is, you know, obviously not fair to put on herself, but is a justification for pushing Maggie away in this. But that's one part of it. But the other part of it is like, as I mentioned before, the clear circling of wagons of us versus them. And like, if it's a question of whose team is Maggie on, she's on Sarah's team. It's the Sarah and Maggie unit. I don't want to say that was never in danger, because Sarah herself is unsure if that was ever in danger. She says this is different than other times, right? And Maggie says, no, we don't know the answer to that. But I think that previous scene where like Jenny was outside and Maggie and Sarah were like having sex on the couch inside, you know, and it was just sort of like, it just never felt like that bond was actually in danger, that Maggie has had her like dalliances, but they never actually threatened the sanctity of this bond. And then Maggie, you know, who has seemed like the nice, kind, caring healthcare worker sort of figure, is the one who's like, you know, Richard and Jenny have to go. And, you know, you have to be the one to make it happen. Call your friend, use your influence, get them gone. And it's a cold moment from her, in this new reality. So I don't know. Did you have any thoughts on that?
Yeah. I mean, it's preservationist, you know, like, and what, when faced with calamity or potential calamity, like, if you have access to that kind of, if you have power's ear, you know, like, why wouldn't you use it? You know, it's like cronyism kind of, it's, you know, it's favor trading, it's whatever, you know, it's, and I love the detail of my friend from Yale.
Oh yeah. Exactly. You know,
and I think we've seen those kind of cultural signifiers in the way the different houses are the two different houses are decorated and stuff. And then Sarah saying, oh, we'll get a palazzo or Baroque palace in the town. And you're like, okay, so you guys are living a very different set of possibilities than the house next door is, you know?
Right.
And again, like going back to what I said earlier, like about this episode kind of casting the show in a kind of colder, shrewder light, like here's a perfect scene kind of demonstrating that, you know, it doesn't make me necessarily like any of them less. It's just not that we need to like them exactly, but like, I think you're just seeing like, okay, like the dreamy thing is over. And now here are the actual mechanics of like how people operate and how they protect themselves and preserve power and deal with problems. A lot of times they just, you know, ship the problem off in whatever way, you know, however that means.
It's, you know, it's the show's constant subversion of expectations in terms of like, we've been waiting for Richard to pop off. And he does in a way at this memorial service, but not in a way that feels like, as you say, you know, as you said earlier, you're not sure this wave is fully crested yet. But like, I think we've been waiting for Danny to explode. We've been waiting for Richard to explode. And like, you know, Richard gets drunk and speaks out of turn in a memorial service. But that's not the, I don't know, American Beauty, Chris Cooper ticking time bomb thing that I've been expecting from him. And, you know, and ultimately it's Sarah who has caused the most damage on this base, in terms of getting three people killed. You know, if we believe that narrative, which I kind of do, like, it sounds like she really skirted convention to send them off when she did, you know. So anyway, yeah. So Richard, I you know, and to have, like, when you talk about cronyism and like to have it be like the lesbian woman who we are used to thinking of kind of as an underdog, and to have her in that position, you know, obviously, like, you know, there's a lot to say about, like, you know, white women and white feminism and like the ways in which they align themselves with power. That's something that we've been talking about a lot in 2020. I think it's really beautifully and chillingly done in this episode. So there you go. Just two more things that I want to talk about. I'm going to talk about the end of the episode first, then circle back to something else. Let's talk about Danny. There's a scene in this episode where, you know, like a chaplain or sorry, I don't know their exact title, asks Sarah if she wants to pray. And she says, you know, like, later, we'll do that later. And then there's also the sequence where we see everyone sort of doing a moment of silence, standing around the base, shots of everyone in, like, wherever they are, stopping and bowing their head, perhaps in prayer or at least self-reflection. But at the end of the episode, we see this, we see Danny, you know, a culmination of his journey in this season, towards a different kind of faith and, trying to find a different kind of peace. Earlier in the episode, in the, like, hellish nightmare party at the Russian house, when he first refuses to have any alcohol, stuff like that, you know, his friends are like, well, now I know there is no God, there is no God, and there is nothing, and stuff like that. And we've been worried about Danny either, like, popping off or whatever it is. But I think this turn of him trying to find peace and connection and meaning in this ceremony, a dangerous ceremony for him to commit, probably on this base or at least in his household, but still one that I think we're supposed to take as a positive, is my interpretation, I think is a really interesting ending to this episode.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's showing certainly that, and I think crucially from a non-American perspective, people who made the show are non-Americans, that, what, you know, the hideous binary that, like, American government and military has used to lightly justify any of the shit we've been doing for decades now, is this, like, well, you know, the Muslim world is against us. Completely forgetting, of course, that there are, like, millions of Muslims in the United States.
Right.
And for one thing. And that, you know, I guess probably the jingo-y American version of this would have been, you know, a forsaking of all Islam or whatever, you know. But what it's showing is that, like, in his grief and anger, he's finding something that's a part of who he is because of who his, you know, biological father is and everything. And he's connecting to it that way, which is what, in its purest form, faith should do, right? To connecting you to yourself and to a sense of purpose and belonging in the world. Yeah, so I think it's a kind of a subversion of, you know, what, like, right after Trump was put in power, like, the Muslim ban went in and all that stuff. And I think it's saying that, like, that, all that anti-Muslim dogma and policy and warfare, does not, you know, crush the faith of a billion people. it's not so simple as to be choose one or the other. It's personal in this case, at least. So I think it's a note that I don't think an American made show, or at least, you know, if Americans had written and directed, it would have made.
And the other moment of peace that sort of comes right before it, we were talking at the top of this episode, this podcast, about Jack Dylan Grazer's performance of Frasier and the kinetic energy sort of in his body and stuff like that. The moment of peace comes on like a FaceTime call or Skype call or whatever it was, between Frasier and Harper, as they just sort of like look quietly at each other. And you know, Frasier is falling asleep. Harper doesn't seem that sleepy, but anyway, just it's a moment of stillness and calm and connection is my reading of it. At the end of all this, and a reaffirmation that like, okay, they went their separate ways in this episode, and you know, either retreated into like, you know, Frasier's family circle or trying to like, you know, see if he fit into Jonathan's circle, and Harper trying to see if they fit into their own old circle, and finding only that relief and calm with each other is what I see here.
Yeah.
You know, in that moment. So.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, you know, I think also just like, you know, watching Frasier fall asleep, it's like, okay, the day ended. You know,
yeah,
and we're gonna go to bed, and then we're gonna wake up, and it's gonna suck tomorrow. But like, there is still some rhythm to the world, even though so much of everything feels now knocked off course or out of orbit.
Yeah,
you know, like when my friend died, like I lived in a tiny studio apartment in Manhattan, and her other very good friend like came over and basically did not leave my tiny apartment for like 4 days, and she slept on my tiny shitty couch that reeked of cigarette smoke, and we just kind of like, you know, woke up and kind of like tried to have a day and then went to sleep, and you know, it was just like you did what you had to, you know, and that closeness felt really nice. And they're teenagers, they can't sleep over each other's houses, especially on a night like that, given what their parents are going through with each other. But it's just, yeah, I think it's just that like it's comforting to return to each other, and also just to know that like the body has its own rhythm, and it like, you know, sleep's going to come, and then you're going to wake up, and then that's going to keep happening and happening and happening until, not you're over it, but like time has passed at least.
Yeah. So, I mean, like overall, this is, barring the pilot, maybe my actual least favorite episode to watch, but I think that's mostly because of the like trauma we're watching all these characters go through. And I the first time I watched it, I didn't like it, and I was like, is this a bad episode? And then I rewatched it again, and then I was like, no, I think it's just, it feels bad to watch it, but that doesn't make it a bad episode. I think it's actually a very good episode. And I don't know where we're going next week and how it could possibly sort of wrap everything up. You know, probably some fallout for Richard's family, but we'll see. But yeah, I mean, it's a really interesting if this is being framed as a kind of before and after, it's really interesting that the after is only two episodes. So we've got the like trauma here, and then what comes after the trauma, we shall see. So
yeah.
Richard, until next week, until we wrap it up in Italy, where can folks find you?
Banging on the door of a movie theater, just trying to get in. You know, what else could we do? While I wait, I'll be tweeting at Rylaws, writing on VF.com. Until our last trip to Northern Italy, Joanna, where will you be?
I mean, technically, I'll be on the Upper East Side with you in New York, but
undoing things that have already been done.
But also maybe listening to some Radiohead. I don't know. Yeah, so I will be grief listening to Radiohead, and you can find me on vanityfair.com. You can find both of us on the podcast Little Gold Men. You can find me on Twitter at Joe Wrote This, and we will see you again and again and again in the coming weeks.
And if you are watching this video, either I'm dead or I'm in a very, very, very bad situation.
She said, oh my God, I can hear gunshots. I can hear men outside.
Where are they? What have they done to them? Are they dead? Are they not dead?
There is one suspect, her father, the Sheikh.
It's Madeline Barron from In the Dark. We've teamed up with our new colleague, Heidi Blake, at The New Yorker to try to answer a question about one of the richest men in the world, the ruler of Dubai.
Why do the women in Sheikh Mohammed's family keep trying to run away?
There's 5 policemen outside and 2 policewomen inside the house. So basically, I'm a hostage.
And he reminded me that Sheikh Mohammed can get me anywhere.
Because you're a rich and powerful person, you can effectively break any law you want in our country and get away with it.
The Runaway Princesses is available now. Follow In the Dark wherever you get your podcasts.
From PRX.